loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In the first hour, we take a look again at two big stories. In our first half an hour, we take a look at President Trump's speech in Pennsylvania over the weekend. Trump gave one of his signature over-the-top speeches last weekend. He supported the execution of drug dealers. He took credit for a successful Olympics and announced that steel and aluminum tariffs would bring jobs back to America. Trump is back in campaign mode, and tomorrow is a special congressional election in southwestern Pennsylvania. Then we take a look at Syria. Today marks the 7th anniversary of the start of the civil war in Syria. More than 465,000 people, Syrians, have been killed. Let that sink in for a minute. More than a million people have been injured, and more than 12 million, half the country's population, have been displaced. We're going to take a look at the Syrian civil war, what gave rise to this conflict, the role of foreign powers, and what's likely to come in Syria's future.
But before we get to Trump's weekend speech, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Donald Trump will get his military parade, although it won't include tanks because they could wreck Washington, D.C.'s roads. Still, experts say the cost of the parade could feed every homeless veteran in America. Next, Immigration and Customs Enforcement has detained a prominent immigrant and reproductive rights activist, Alejandra Pablos. She's not undocumented, but is a legal permanent resident. She had a DUI arrest nearly a decade ago, and advocates say her detention is a result of her activism, and especially for a recent protest she led against the Department of Homeland Security. Then China's legislature approved the proposal to remove term limits on the country's presidency yesterday, setting the stage of President Xi Jinping to continue in office after his current five-year term ends in 2023. And then Colombia voted in legislative elections Sunday as the country's peace process struggles to stay alive amid a wave of paramilitary violence. Yesterday's election comes ahead of the presidential polls in May and June. And finally, we have an analysis of the Pennsylvania special election coming up this week. And in other headlines, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos continued her defense of Donald Trump's controversial proposal to arm school teachers. On NBC's Today Show, DeVos argued that, quote, "the schools should have this tool if they choose to use the tool," unquote. Calls for new gun control measures have intensified in the wake of the Parkland school shooting and student protests that swept the country. Rex Tillerson sounded a cautious note on the announced meeting between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Speaking from Nigeria, Tillerson said, quote, "We have not heard anything directly back from North Korea, although we do expect to hear something directly from them," unquote. Adding, quote, "I would say remain patient and we'll see what happens," unquote. Opponents of the Trump-Kim meeting have been applying intense pressure on the administration to cancel the summit. An article in the New York Times alleges that detained members of the Saudi elite were tortured as part of the sweeping purge of the royal family orchestrated by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, including a general who was reportedly tortured to death. The Saudi government denies these claims. Mohammed bin Salman has rapidly consolidated power over his rivals in anticipation of taking the throne after the end of the reign of his elderly father. 49 people died after a tragic plane accident in Nepal. A Bangladeshi plane carrying more than 70 passengers crashed as it was approaching the runway at a Kathmandu airport and then burst into flames. Authorities are blaming the crash on pilot error. Sputnik News is reporting that in two separate explosions in Austin, Texas, Monday, a 17-year-old boy was killed and two women, one in middle age and one in her 70s, were injured. The explosions were the second and third in the city this month. Austin Interim Police Chief Brian Manley noted, quote, "We do know that both of the homes that were the recipients of these packages belong to African Americans, so we cannot rule out that a hate crime is at the core of this." Those are today's headlines. Next up is Trump's weekend speech in Pennsylvania. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Pennsylvania. President Trump gave one of his signature over-the-top speeches in Pennsylvania last weekend. Instead of touting the accomplishments of the congressional nominee he was supposedly campaigning for, or talking about bringing jobs to the economically strapped region, he advocated executing drug dealers and promoted myths about himself. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Chenga. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor at Progressive Army and host of the show The Way with Anoa. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, producer of Loud and Clear. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I may have overstated that a little bit. He did talk about jobs for a couple of seconds, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. But Anoa, let's talk first about the importance of this race to the Republicans. It's actually not that important in terms of the loss of one single seat, but it has great political significance. Why don't you talk about that?
Sure. Like, I think we've seen, you know, post-Trump, when these special elections happen, there's a lot of focus on, you know, what does this mean now? What is his brand and capability as, you know, a leader, and whether or not Republicans are able to hold on to their seats? Will they be able to really build the support necessary, right? Like, as we've seen these special elections, you know, here in Georgia with the Georgia 6th race, it wasn't so much the Republican was able to hold on to the seat as much as, you know, the Democrat strategy just sucked. But we look at these special elections, particularly this one where there is a real challenge, right? In a presumably red district, arguably red district, there's a real challenge to whether or not, you know, the Rick Saccone will be able to actually win and keep that seat, you know, red. And Trump is out there trying to stump, and we saw his candidate in the Alabama Senate race did not win because he was not a Roy Moore supporter originally. And so Trump is not really, he's not good at a lot of stuff, but this doesn't seem to be something that he's particularly good at either. He's trying to do that regular stump support thing, and it doesn't really seem to work with him. He's talking about, you know, having drug dealers be facing the death penalty for their role in the opioid epidemic.
I don't know if we're actually going to start bringing criminal charges against the pharmaceutical industry or let alone pursuing the death penalty. We're really concerned about the opioid epidemic and what is happening across America. We really have to look at the way in which the increase in, you know, certain drugs and basically, you know, pain pill mills and things of that nature, how they have impacted, you know, this epidemic that we're grappling with as a nation. So it's really amusing to me to hear him say things like, you know, we need to have drug dealers face the death penalty because some of the worst pushers, drug dealers, currently are those who are sanctioned by law to do what they're doing.
Before we get into Donald Trump on this campaign trail, I want to talk about this race just for a second. We're going to talk about it later in the next hour, but I want to raise something that we're not going to be discussing in the next hour, and that is the outside money that has flowed into this district. It's flooded the district. So far, $11.7 million has been spent on advertising, just on advertising, in this little backwoods district in southwestern Pennsylvania. And frankly, more of the money has been spent by the Democrat than by the Republican. And an important point too, and it's kind of funny in the greater scheme of things, this district is going to cease to exist in a few months because of Supreme Court mandated redistricting. So this is all for show. This entire race is for show. And that's why almost everybody in any position of authority at the White House has made their way to Pittsburgh in the last 2 months. Kellyanne Conway was there just 2 days ago, 3 days ago. Donald Trump was there day before yesterday. Mike Pence has made two trips. Trump now has made two trips. But everybody's running to Pennsylvania just because they don't want to be embarrassed by losing this race.
It shows the vapidness.
It really does.
Of American democracy and how money and, you know, opportunism are meddling in our democracy. As you said, it's symbolic, but also, Nicole and Anoa, what this really signifies, it seems to me, is that Donald Trump has entered not simply the 2018 midterm election cycle where he can be back on the campaign trail. This is what he's going to be doing for the next 3 years because it's much better for Donald Trump.
He actually, in his speech this weekend, noted that he had been so successful already in his, you know, first short bit in office that he could just coast up until 2020 and be just fine. So I think that's what he's thinking.
Anoa, he's in campaign mode now.
He's definitely in campaign mode now, because what is the new slogan? Keep America great. And America is just so great with him in leadership so far. So, yeah, it's interesting. He's like, you know, we've been doing good things, and we're going to keep doing great things, and we're going to keep doing these things. And it's like, dude, do you even know what's going on? I Republicans really concern me, right? Because once upon a time, there was this illusion, at least, right, that Republicans actually cared about things like, you know, the size of government's role in our lives, and they actually had standards, allegedly. Right. It just seems like now, you know, we've already seen in the last several years, but really now with Donald Trump and just little pushback from, you know, mainstream Republicans, it's just like, yeah, I'm saying these things and I don't agree with him, but I'm still voting for stuff and doing things. And really the same thing with Democrats as well. So it's hard, I think, for people when we're going into another election cycle to really take it seriously that we're supposed to be resisting Trump, or Trump is so evil and awful, when, you know, the same people who are telling us we need to donate money to make sure Connor Lamb wins will turn around and vote and go along with what Trump wants to do on his agenda. And it's a problem.
Yeah, we can see that all over the place. I mean, look at what just happened in Alabama with Doug Jones.
That's right.
I mean, Jones is, you know, because of the grassroots effort by primarily African-American women in the state of Alabama, not the DNC nationally, because of a grassroots effort, Doug Jones, the Democrats, won in Alabama. That was a big surprise. But once in office, Doug Jones is tacked to the right. He's almost part of the Trump entourage right now. I want to play an audio clip from the speech. Again, Donald Trump is in campaign mode, so it says a lot of different things. Undoubtedly, the media that hates Donald Trump will continue to give him all that free coverage, because as they've said over and over again, as Les Moom's CEO of CBS said, this may be bad for the country, but it's good for us, good for our ratings. Let's listen to Donald Trump, and then I want to get Nicole and Anoa to comment on it. It's classic Donald Trump.
But you know what's going to happen? Did you see the other day? 96% of what they do, all I do is good stuff. The economy is the best it's ever been. Your coal. By the way, folks, some of you are in the coal world. Your coal is coming back big, 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 big. Your steel is coming back. Your steel is coming back. Those plants are going to be opening. And what we've done with the 25% tariffs for those guys that come in and dump their steel all over the place. And by the way.
He said. The steel was crap.
It's crap. Never mind that most American cars are made with imported steel. Oh, it's crap.
What even was he saying? Like, what?
Well, 96%.
Yes, 96% something, 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 et cetera. I have no idea what he was just trying to say, but he did mention tariffs and seemed to connect that with steel and jobs coming back to this country. But we obviously know that all of those things will be even further automated. And that the people who need jobs will not be guaranteed jobs. We are only guaranteeing profit if we do that.
Yeah, that's an important point, I know, that Nicole is making. That the reason the country has lost steel jobs is either because steel corporations have gone overseas in pursuit of lower wages, or because, and even more importantly, the number of people needed to produce one ton of steel, the number of actual living laborers, has diminished by a factor of 10 in the last 20 years. So it takes one-tenth of what it used to take to produce the same amount of steel, that because of technology, because of automation. And yes, you know, I actually believe tariffs are really popular right now. We see this playing out in Pennsylvania in steel territory, and it'll also where there are aluminum factories. But the bottom line is, if the steel companies, Anoa, make mega profits as a consequence of the tax windfall, or because of the basically taxing foreign steel or foreign aluminum and driving it out of the market, those corporations that make extra money don't have to put that money into creating new jobs or new factories. They can do whatever they want with that money, which could be to put that money into automation or robotization of existing jobs. We see that all the time. The corporate bigwigs have discretion to do with that extra money whatever they want to do. They can play the stock market. They can buy back stock options. They don't have to bring back jobs. I mean, this, in fact, is pulling the rug over people's eyes, throwing sand in their eyes. because there's no guarantees at all that this will bring jobs. Go ahead, Anoa.
Well, and that's what we've seen with, you know, the tax cuts, right? Like, we saw the same thing then as well. You know, yay, Walmart's giving out all these bonuses, but wait, look, they're closing down stores, they're laying people off, Sam's Club is doing X, Y, and Z. Like, AT&T, yay, is giving this, but AT&T also just laid off people off. Like, they're incentivizing, you know, corporations to continue to be these bad actors while simultaneously providing them cover, pretending like, hey, look, this good thing happened. And there really isn't anything in what he's proposing to do, what Democrats have allowed to happen, you know, by their own compliance and complacency in terms of the way corporations are not just simply leaving Americans behind in this case, you know, thinking about the steel industry specifically. It's not just that they're leaving American jobs, American workers behind. Like, they're just blatantly disregarding any opportunity to help uplift and invest and just simply, you know, making whatever the biggest profit, record profit would be for this next quarter, this next year. And there's a problem with that. You know, people act like in capitalism, it's just supposed to be ruthless and cutthroat and making profit. And there should be no concern for people at all, which is why so many people are advocating for, you know, dismantling. But, you know, we need to do better, I think, on the left in terms of when we're engaging people, because the problem is people like Trump will speak and they sound like they're making sense. You know, they'll appeal to people who say things like, well, shouldn't people be able to make money if they want to while they themselves have none? And we have to find a way to reach people so that we can overcome those challenges so that we don't have people like a Trump or like a Schumer, you know, as the ones making those decisions and stuff. It's great to rail on them for the way we do, but at the same time, we need to help people understand why the rhetoric doesn't make sense. We can't just give them more rhetoric.
I agree with you.
You know, this speech was not all politics and self-congratulations either. President Trump said something that to me was chilling. And I will admit to you that I'm biased because I've been in prison and I know people who have made some mistakes in their lives and have served time in prison. They're not bad people. They made a bad decision. But he made some pointed comments about executing drug dealers.
Yeah, let's listen to the audio clip of Donald Trump talking about this. And you're right. When people hear this, and Nicole, we'll toss it back to you, people have to, outside of the, quote, recreational value of Donald Trump's speeches, and that's partly what he's doing, we do have to talk about content and what it means for society and what thus becomes acceptable.
That's right, because there are consequences when the president of the United States says things that are outrageous.
Let's listen to Trump.
Hey, if you're a drug dealer and you know you're going to get caught, and you know that you're going to kill people, you're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our kids. They're killing our families. They're killing our workers.
Well, he then went on to say drug dealers should be executed, or you said it kind of laughingly.
So I'm really glad we're talking about this in a serious way, actually, because there are some states that have proposed these bills. If you have been at all involved in a drug deal, there are some states that have proposed allowing life in prison or death penalty for those cases.
Well, in fact, the federal government does have the death penalty for major drug importers.
There you go. And I think it's really problematic for a number of reasons. And I want to get into there's some research. There's actually a lot of research behind this. When you try to replace people in drug markets, there are always people waiting in the wings to easily replace, especially those lower level. But even at the higher level, there's always people who can be kind of promoted within those organizations, and especially in communities where there aren't. I mean, you know, we know we have an unemployment rate now that's supposed to be low, but we also know in Black and brown and poor communities that that unemployment rate is much, much higher, people who are underemployed. And so there's always people who are willing to step in. And so we know that sending people to prison when they're drug dealers is actually not something that is effective. We also know there's a massive amount of research that shows that extreme penalties don't work as deterrents either, because people don't believe that that's actually going to happen to them because it's so insane. And even further, practitioners in systems, when there are extreme penalties, also get, you know, they get cold feet about actually charging somebody with something that's going to end up with them dying. I mean, that's a big deal, and people don't want to do that. So the system starts to break down at that point. It just is a terrible idea for a million reasons. But, and then, you know, obviously this is a massive, you know, expansion of state power, of a repressive state power. And that is obviously unconscionable and something that is funny on its face, I guess, until you realize, like, that's insane and should absolutely not be anything that happens.
Yeah, funny on its face, but not actually funny. And Anoa, let's go back to the point that you were making about this, about who actually gets punished for drug dealing. Wells Fargo purchased Wachovia Bank after the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Wachovia Bank was found guilty or pled guilty to money laundering to the tune of $360 billion of drug money. Then Wells Fargo bought up Wachovia for a song and paid a $161 million fine. No Wachovia executive went to prison, not to mention being executed. They just, their corporations paid a civil penalty, and then Wells Fargo bought them up, took their assets and their depositors and paid us what amounts to a nothing, a $160 million fine on a $370 billion conviction of drug laundering. Anyway, go ahead, Anoa.
I mean, yeah, like, absolutely. Like, when we really look and see at the focus, right, when we're really actually looking at, and he's convoluting issues too there, right? When he's talking about, you know, you have this gang, which he's mentioned before, in his State of the Union address, to clearly inflame and feed into this nonsense of, you know, the quote-unquote illegal criminal aliens, which is a theme that's playing out here in our own gubernatorial race down here in Georgia as well. Like, you're clearly trying to get riled people up, and then you throw in this other thing, because so gangs deal drugs, so then you throw this other thing about opioid abuse, and then voila. We should be going after the killer Mexican gangs because they're the reasons why the opioid abuse is, and we need ICE to come in. Like he creates these mountains out of these, not even molehills, like, it's nothingness. But he creates these mountains of ridiculousness. And unfortunately, people will pick up bits and pieces and draw conclusions, and then they themselves then go out there and they repeat to others and do the same thing. But we have a system set up that will criminalize and penalize those who are not the ones that are creating the greatest destabilization to our actual government in existence. And like you talked about the housing crisis, when we looked at really not just how that destabilized and caused issues with housing. I mean, we have communities that are still feeling the effects of massive foreclosures and turnovers, you know, a decade later. But we looked at how that completely destabilized our economy, right? And in the destabilization of our economy, it caused people, you know, their jobs. People, if you were coming out of law school like myself, it cost people the jobs they expected to get or the careers they thought they would have. I mean, it set so much in motion and really caused so much damage and havoc. And yet, if you are a protester and you just happen to be in the vicinity, according to the prosecutors who were prosecuting the remaining folks in the J-20 trials, if you just happen to be in the vicinity of property damage happening, you're not only liable for that property damage, you're liable for riotous behavior and potentially facing 60 years in jail. Like, the imbalance in our criminal justice system is just, it's insane. And when we look at this type of, you know, malfeasance on such a large scale, it's really telling to see where the priorities are.
I totally agree with you, Anoa. And this is even worse when we're in the same conversation in the same week, in the same month, talking about repealing Dodd-Frank, which was something that, you know, was a common sense set of measures to try to help after the financial crisis. And it's something that people on both sides of the aisle are supporting, which is just absolutely insane.
None of that could pass without the Democratic Party. And
that's
the Democratic Party will be right there, because guess what? The Democratic Party, just like Trump and the Republican Party, are connected to, tied to, symbiotic with Wall Street banks, with the military industrial complex. We have about 4 minutes left. I want to play for our third and final clip from our leader, Donald J. Trump. This is him talking about, again, oddly, his importance, his paramount importance in global politics, and apparently also in sports. Let's listen to Donald Trump.
Now, they just left North Korea. And look, North Korea is tough. They're testing nuclear weapons. They're doing a lot of things. This should have been handled, by the way, over the last 30 years, not now. That's when it should have been handled. We shouldn't have handled it. This should have been handled, and everybody will say it too, but that's okay, because that's what we do. We handle things. And these guys came out and they said that your president's done a great job, I might say. But, well, I'll tell you, we did a great job in the Olympics. President Moon of South Korea said without Donald Trump, the Olympics would have been a total failure. It's true. True. You know? Might as well say it.
Without Donald Trump, the Olympics would have been a failure.
Yeah, he was. He competed the best of everybody for sure. He did great.
I know. It's actually hard not to laugh. Well, we are laughing. But Donald Trump is taking credit for all things. When you think about what's actually happening on the Korean Peninsula, though, just to have a more sober note, Moon Jae-in and the South Korean government, they want to reduce the tensions and the possibility of war. So does the North Korean government. They've started their own process. That process is going forward. That train is leaving the station, the train towards a peaceful settlement of the Korean Peninsula. And Mike Pence wasn't on the train. It seems to me that Donald Trump, who's now claiming credit, is just scrambling to get on board. He's now agreed to a meeting, supposedly, with Kim Jong-un. As a consequence, Donald Trump is positioning himself. He hopes to be the great deal maker, maybe like Nixon opening up the People's Republic of China to a new era. Who knows what he wants? He certainly doesn't want to be seen as a failing, semi-bankrupt, mid-level real estate developer and reality TV star whose star was on the eclipse. He wants to be viewed as something else. Go ahead. We have 2 minutes left.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And at this point, I'm just kind of like, it's fascinating listening to him speak. I'm beyond like, I know a lot of people get flustered when they hear him, but it's fascinating to me because he seems to really believe his own assumptions. And it'll be really interesting to see how, you know, this plays out over the next couple of years as he continues to have opportunities to engage with the world stage, in these various settings. But I really think that just bringing it back into this race and into, you know, the midterm election, that there is this focus because he is so stupid. He's such a buffoon. There's so much that we can focus on. But at the same time, you know, people are still losing to him and to people who, reinforce what he's about. And we need to find a way to make sure that we're talking to people in a way that's accessible and engaging and pointing out why it's a problem.
Anoa is right, John. We have less than a minute, but the tariff measure, the 25% on steel, the 10% on aluminum, it'll hurt a lot of industries. It'll hurt a lot of jobs, including especially auto. But right now in Southwest Pennsylvania, in steel territory, it's playing well. And even the Democrats are now completely embracing, the Democratic challenger is completely embracing Trump's policy. Actually, that weakens the Democrats a great deal.
It does. There's been some real role reversal in this race, and it's been because of tariffs. Tariffs normally have been the domain of the labor movement and Democrats, especially these conservative Democrats in Western Pennsylvania. But it's flipped, and now it's the Republicans pushing tariffs. And I think that Connor Lamb, the Democratic nominee, thinks the only way he might be able to win this race is to latch onto this.
Yeah, and we'll find out tomorrow.
Indeed, we will.
Anyway, that's all the time we have. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We've been speaking with Anoa Changa in Atlanta, Georgia. She's the host of The Way with Anoa, and with Nicole Roussel, the producer here on Loud and Clear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today marks the 7th anniversary of the start of the war in Syria. More than 450,000 Syrians have been killed. Let that sink in for a minute. More than 1 million have been injured. Millions, maybe half the country's population in total, have been displaced at least at some point during this long ordeal. We are joined from Beirut by Jana Nakal. She is an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. And we're joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Jana and Masoud, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Thank you for joining. Jana, let's start with you. 7th anniversary. You just returned from a 1,000-mile-long trip throughout Syria before you returned to Beirut. Talk about what you saw and why you were on this sojourn, including the trip to Afrin.
So I went there as part of the LCPs, the Lebanese Communist Party's participation in a women's delegation in the occasion of Women's Day to support the peoples of the land of Afrin against the occupation, the Turkish occupation. And so, yes, we traveled through the north of Syria from the east all over to the west of Syria. We spent the whole week there traveling through land and spending 3 nights in Afrin supporting the people under siege in Afrin. While traveling, I mean, I have lived under the civil war in Lebanon, a 30-year long civil war. And it was very much similar to what we have been through. The destruction that is there, the emptiness. I mean, we drove through like miles and miles of empty lands because the peoples of the lands didn't come back after the war. We also went to Aleppo, in which we saw, for instance, the whole Palestinian camp, which looks like it was beautiful, and it was all totally destroyed. Unfortunately, it's not only the lands which are destroyed and the buildings, but also social ties and people's relationships to one another. One of the most important things was also the Kurdish relationship vis-a-vis the Arabs. There's a huge, lack of trust between these different communities, which once were part of a whole country. Unfortunately, when driving through Syria, you can see the lack of hope. People cannot talk about a tomorrow in Syria, because even if they're in the region where they're living, there's no war anymore. Wars are starting here and there along different regions in Syria. So unless there is an actual peace in Syria, there won't be any kind of solution, neither political, nor social, nor economic one.
That's the voice of Jana Nakhal. She is an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party, just returned from Syria. Masoud Shajaray is another guest. He's talking to us from London. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, when we were preparing this segment, we were using the language Syria civil war. But when you think about the last 7 miserable years where this beautiful, historic, and central country to the Arab world has been just ripped apart, fragmented, with so many killed and so many people driven into refugee status, you can't think of this as simply a civil war because of the interference in the direct intervention of others. Starting in 2011 and shortly after the NATO bombing led to the destruction of the Libyan regime and the killing, the execution in the streets of the head of state there, the U.S. government, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, all of the entire Washington establishment, I think they felt the bit in their mouth. They felt confident that regime change would be on the order of the day in Syria. And so the mantra became Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. And thus the Western powers and their allies like Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia thought, of course, Syria would fall. But here we are 7 years later. The government has not fallen. Others on the international arena have intervened on its behalf. So the Syria war is a war that has so many different players and parts and pieces to it. When you think back about these 7 years, what are your principal reflections?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the civil war was the tool which was used to destroy and dismantle the whole Syrian nation and destroy everything. I mean, we just heard, it's not just the buildings destroyed, people's lives destroyed, the whole fabric of the society, the relationships between people, not just different sections of the community, but even within the same family. The destruction has been so total. And unfortunately, this came, first we had Iraq, and, we had this thing that we have to go and start the weapons of mass destructions, and we went and destroyed the whole nation. Still up to this day, hundreds and thousands of people are dying innocently. And, the mess which was left behind, which eventually had to be cleaned up, the creation and support to Daesh. And then, you know, we sort of didn't learn any lesson. If there was a lesson to be, there was a lesson to be learned, but I don't know anybody was really thinking of learning any lesson. So the same policy was continued in Libya, and total destruction. And we've got the same chaos and destructions there. Then the whole excuse of the so-called Arab Spring was used in Syria. And it's very interesting, you know, when you look at the whole of the Arab nation, all those dictatorships, satellite states, which are actually agents of Western United States, they sort of survive all these sort of pro-democracy. And if anything, you know, they re-strengthen themselves, including Egypt you know, we see in Bahrain and elsewhere. So this was really a deliberate situation to destroy certain sections of Middle East and certain nations which didn't want to play ball with the West, and to destroy them to the extent that there will be nothing left of it. But you know, I think the Syrian situation was different. People fought back. Others came to support. And you know, eventually Daesh have been sort of almost destroyed in both Iraq and Syria. And no thanks to the West, which have armed them very clearly and very systematically, and you know, allow them to sort of sell oil, etc., and etc. And if it wasn't because of Russia and Iran and Hezbollah getting involved, we would have seen the total, probably, destruction of Syria and total destruction of Iraq.
Yeah, that's true. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking about Syria and the Syrian civil war with two guests from Beirut. We're joined by Jeanna Nakal. She's an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. And we're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Jeanna, I'd like to ask you, you're the first person that I've spoken to in at least 6 months who's been to Afrin and has seen it with her own eyes. Can you tell us what you saw vis-a-vis refugees and medical care and aid that's getting into the country? What's the situation like on the ground there?
Okay, so Afrin, the city, is currently under siege. When we arrived to Afrin, which is on the 7th, the Turkish army, along with the Takfiri mercenaries, were around 10 kilometers away from the city of Afrin, while they had occupied almost 110 villages, in addition to four towns from the area of Afrin. We left on the 11th, on the 10th, and this is when the Turkish army and the mercenaries were around 3 kilometers away. Today, we have news about the siege being totally closed. There was only one crossing. Now, supposedly, the crossing is not really open. The Turks are... This is part of the biggest, let's say, plan of the Turks, which is to actually neutralize the strengths of the Kurds, but also to occupy Syrian lands. Now, the situation in the city is that the city is hosting the majority of the displaced from the 110 and more villages. So the city has almost around 500,000 people. There's not much electricity. There is water shortages. But at the same time, the one crossing that was open was allowing the Syrian state, the Syrian army, as well as the other Kurds, to actually deliver support and food. I don't know what's going on now, if there is food still coming in. But mostly a lot of the people who were still in Afrin have tried to run away from the same or escape from the same crossing to areas which are farther away from the Turkish occupation. Meanwhile, we're looking at a very serious occupation, because this can link up to Aleppo, linking up to Idlib, where the Islamists are from, are staying, which means that the whole northern western area of Syria will be occupied by the Turks and their takfiri militaries, mercenaries.
Yeah, you know, it seems that the Turks, as bad as the U.S. involvement is in Syria, and we've talked about this a lot on this show, we both believe, and I think we believe correctly, that the U.S. involvement in Syria is illegal. It's a violation of international law. We don't have the authority of the U.N. Security Council to be there, but neither does Turkey. And, you know, Turkey has done nothing but cause misery. I'm not in any way trying to advocate or to make excuses for the U.S. involvement in Syria. But the Turks are just as guilty, and the Turks need to get out of Syria.
Yes, and we need to talk about the history of between the Kurds and the Turks, specifically that the constituency of the area there is majority of Kurds, within which there are Yazidis, which we also know about what the Takfiris do with the Yazidis. So it's very much dangerous. It's a very serious issue happening there, and it is definitely an occupation of Syrian land.
Masoud, let's go back to you. Everything has changed so many times and in so many different ways. You had Russia intervening decisively, I would say, but in support of the Assad government. The Russians made the argument when they came in that the Syrian government, no matter who was its leader, was an indispensable force for the defeat of terrorist entities. At the same time, Turkey, Iran with Russia became the guarantors of a peace process that took place in Kazakhstan. Now you have the Turks occupying Afrin and parts of northern Syria. And at the same time, the Russian government is the ally of the Assad government. Where does that leave Russia in terms of its relationship both with Assad and in particular in this instance with Turkey?
Well, it creates a very difficult situation. I mean, we have had so many changing of sides and sort of people pretending to be wanting, but in reality behaving against the interests of ordinary Syrian. And Turkey has been involved in different parts of this picture. And I agree with our colleague that one of the most important things of Turkish involvement is the way that Turkey behaves towards the Kurdish community, both in Turkey and elsewhere. And they seem to be incompetent and to have any sort of solution within their own Turkish Kurdish community, let alone what they would do with others. And I think from that point of view, the sort of atrocities that Turkey has committed against the Kurds for a very long time, it makes it extremely dangerous to be involved in that region. But I think we need to sort of hope that eventually the coalition of Russian, Iranian, and the Syrians will actually come together and address the issue of Turkey. Turkey has been changing size so many times, which, you know, I think no one in the region, ordinary people in the region, we trust it. And their involvement with the Takfiris has been from the beginning. And indeed, their support of Daesh, which allowed Daesh to actually sell oil and survive for so long and sustain their atrocities and their power, it is again a reality that everybody knows now. So I think it's very difficult to maneuver between this because Turkey has got this sort of ambition to occupy parts of the Syria. And he's got the other ambition to crush the Kurds, crush them and then actually find a sort of military solution to so-called its Kurdish problem rather than actually finding a solution, a political settlement, which is the only way forward. I think it's very worrying. The signs are very worrying, and people changing sides all the time is extremely worrying. But what has been stabilizing, and I want to repeat this, what has been stabilizing is the support of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah,
which has really sort of supported some sort of stability, not just in Syria, but in Iraq as well.
Jana Nakhal, I want to ask you about the Kurds and their orientation inside of Syria. The YPG, the Kurdish Protection Units, generally speaking, you would characterize, not you, but one would characterize the Kurds as coming from the left. At the same time, there is the national question for them, the desire to have their own autonomous area, their own self-governance, or and maybe in some instances, independence, since the Kurds were denied statehood at the end of the World War I as a consequence of secret agreements, the Sykes-Picot Treaty, etc. But how does the Lebanese left, you're from the Lebanese Communist Party, how does the Lebanese left view the Kurdish movement in Syria or in Turkey for that matter? And are there any relations or discussions or liaisons that take place, political discussions about how some of these questions can be solved from a progressive point of view?
So let's start with the fact that Kurds are an integral constituent of this region. They're one of the many peoples of this region. Part of this delegation, or the aim of this delegation, of us going to Afrin specifically, supporting them and talking to them and listening to them, is to see, to tell them that we still support them in their struggle against the Turks, and that because they have this connection with the Americans that we don't agree with, we still think that they need to go back to this region to be an integral part of this region again, to be supported by the peoples of this region and free their lands from the Americans. Now, the specificities of the Kurds, when you're talking about the independence, Öcalan, who's the major, let's say, theoretician of the PKK, YPJ, and YPG, of their political forces, had written not about an independent, but the fact that they have to have their rights, they have to have their own languages, etc., but they are a constituent of the region. So they're not asking for independence. This has to be clarified. The problem is, of course, as we have mentioned, that they have been collaborating with the Americans. And I think it's because of a long history of problems and racism with the Arab peoples of the region, as well as within the Syrian war. This has made the Kurds feel excluded and needing a support from abroad. And this support came from America. So for us, it's very important to reclaim the space for the Kurds, to make them part of the region, to make their causes, their lands in Afrin and other places, lands that we all should defend, and a Syrian land that Kurds and Arabs should defend together.
That is the most sober and concise explanation of the situation on the ground in Syria that I think we've heard. I really do. Nobody's talking about the Kurds, and the Kurds have to be a part of this solution. Otherwise, there won't be a solution. We're just going to see more bloodshed.
And at the same time, if the Kurds end up outside and not as an integral part of the region and the peoples of the region, but if they're manipulated by, for military exigency purposes, an imperial power like America, that then puts them somewhere else. A tricky and complicated question, very complicated for the Kurds. But Masoud, can you envision the Syrian Arab army that the Kurds obviously had many contradictions with and struggles with, because of the new constellation of forces, finding a way to bridge this gap, to make a military alliance with the Kurds against the Turks, for instance, and also, but conditioned on a demand that the Kurds would also repudiate the American presence, which is illegal, as John Kiriakou said, inside of Syria. Is that a possible outcome?
Yeah, well, if you remember a few weeks ago, at the beginning of this invasion, the Syrian army and some of the supporters tried to actually go in support of the Kurds to Afrin, and they were bombed by the Turkish forces. I think if we remove the manipulation of the Kurdish community by the colonial powers, and you know, I have to add the involvement of Israel in this, because that is actually quite obvious and very clear now, which has been all designed to divide and rule. And I think this is something that the people of the region, the Arab community, the Kurdish community, and others need to come together to, for surviving and protecting their independence. And, you know, in Syria, believe it or not, all these communities were living quite happily together. And this sort of deliberate creation of civil war and the chaos have actually created this environment. And I think, you know, I hope and pray that they will wake up to the fact that the involvement of outsiders into their region is not a healthy one, is not for their benefit. It's there to create chaos. And, you know, chaos, it suits the colonial powers, chaos suits Israel, and chaos is what they want to create. No, you know, and people need to wake up to that reality. And that is the only solution. The only solution forward is for people of that region to come together and recognize that all these chaos have been created by the outsiders for their benefit. And they need to go back to promoting first and foremost is their independence.
Jean and Nichal, I have to ask you, what is the role of Israel in this whole dispute? Israel has attacked and occupied your country. Israel's been quick to use its planes and its weapons in Syria. Is there a role for Israel in this whole thing?
And Israel has been supporting and giving refuge and house support to members of the Free Syrian Army, as well as other Takfiri groups. So the role of Israel is very clear. Whatever is destabilizes the neighboring countries, whatever destabilizes resistance, whatever destabilizes the context and the social, political, military, and economic context of resistance is very supportive of Israel. I mean, I've been working with refugees around Lebanon since 2014. The discourse that you would never hear from Syrians is now there. People coming from Syria asking me, why are we enemies with Israel? Syrians asking, what did Israel do bad for them? Syrians asking, is Israel really the real enemy? This is exactly what Israel wants, and it's getting out of this war.
That's interesting. So in other words, the consciousness as a consequence of all the dislocation and suffering is impacting people's views, Syrian people's or Syrian refugees' views on Israel itself. That's what you're saying.
Yes, because the enemy is not Israel anymore. The enemy is Bashar. The enemy is the Syrian army. Of course, there's a lot of problems that started the uprising in Syria, but it does not mean that that the major enemy in the region, the major imperialist presence in the region, is not Israel.
Yeah. And Masoud and Jana, we only have about 3.5 minutes left. Real quick, because people, especially people here, won't know how this war started. There's just an assumption. Assad killed all of his own people. He was like, woke up one morning, there were a peaceful protest, and so he decided to slaughter everybody. That's the narrative. What did start the war? Go ahead, Masoud. How did it end up as an armed conflict?
Well, it was designed to be armed conflict. Armed was brought into the region and sort of hijacked the legitimate wishes of some of the section of society. Actually, wanted to have more freedom and more say in their society. And this is the reality that has been used over and over, and you know, it to turn a legitimate aspiration of a section of community into an armed conflict was exactly what happened, and it was well designed, and it was done with impunity, and indeed, unfortunately, was successful. And one of the reasons it's done is because colonialism actually needs to have chaos, and then we'll come around and say that it will bring sort of a tranquility to the society, and that's how it actually sells itself everywhere.
Jana, we have a little less than 3 minutes, 2.5. I want to ask you if you see it that way as well. In other words, and this is a debate that goes on, was the fragmentation of Syria, and of course there's been the fragmentation of Libya, the fragmentation of Iraq, was this a consequence of a sort of a planned out, deliberate strategy to destabilize, to create chaos, as Massoud put it, thus allowing the colonial powers to come in and quote, stabilize or bring order? Or is this something else, like a process that just got out of control, whereby the West stimulated an armed struggle which against what might have been a peaceful protest, and things just have taken on their own life? Or is it both? Go ahead.
I think it started actually from 2006, where Israel thought that it can destroy resistance simply by destroying Lebanon. It destroyed Lebanon, but was not able to destroy the resistance. So it thought it can, one way or another, go to the root of the problem, which is for its Syria, not Iran, because it cannot really fight with Iran now. And so create this whole chaos, like Mas'ud called it, in Syria. There was some reasons for the uprisings, let's call them, in 2011. There was some reasons for the, let's say, bad situation, the bad economic situation in which people were living because of the newly introduced neoliberal policies. But it does not mean that the direction and the size and impact of these uprisings were led by the people. It was very easy for the West, for America and Israel, to abuse and exploit these uprisings and direct them the way they wanted them. The uprisings became Islamists, Takfiris, the uprisings became armed, and this is not something unthought of or unplanned.
Okay, sadly, we are out of time. We would have liked to have continued. That was the voice of Jana Nakhal. She's an independent researcher and a member of the Central Committee of the Lebanese Communist Party. She's just returned from a long trip throughout Syria, including a visit to Afrin, where she was for 3 days. Of course, Afrin is the northern, mainly Kurdish city in area in northern Syria, which is under siege by Turkey. And we've been joined from London by Massoud Shajareh. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.